begin. I want to thank everyone for coming and take this last opportunity to thank Ellie Lassen and Pam Lehman for their efforts in organizing the series, and all of our previous hosts, as well as the Bernards for hosting this evening. Thank you very much for opening your beautiful home. Thank you for the bar. I was gonna. If the only reason I didn't use the bar stool was because I would be too tempted to go into a comedy routine, and I wasn't sure if I was that funny. My wife tells me I'm not, so I thought I should stick with what I supposedly know. I wanted to just take a brief review of what we did last week, and really, this week's lecture does stand on its own, but at the same time, it is crucially connected to last week's. Not really to the first one, but to last week's. But I know that there were some people who were out of town last week, maybe here this evening. So just to mention, last week we did a very important study, and that was that we focused on the fact that despite the significance of the Rambam as a person and even some of the influence of the 13 principles, we studied how among his contemporaries or immediately after him in the Rishonim, in the period of the Middle Ages, there was an interesting amount of debate about the Rambam's 13 principles. They were not universally accepted. And as a whole, he had criticism on two ends. One end, which I called his conservative flank, if you will, was that he had been too liberal. He only mentioned 13, said the Abarbanel, how can you limit it to 13? It's everything. Everything. Every little pasuk, every little idea, everything. You have to believe in everything. We pointed out the unbelievable irony of that critique by the Abarbanel. Don Yitzchak Abarbanel, again, the great Spanish, I mean, he wasn't just a Rishon, I mean, he was a financier, and the king of Portugal, and then the king and queen of Spain, was exiled, right, at the same time Christopher Columbus in 1492, I mean, unbelievable personality. He has this little book called Rosh Amana. The first 22 chapters are defending the Rambam from the criticisms that we're about to get to from the other camp, and then in the last two chapters, 23 and 24, he changes gears and has his own criticism and ultimately rejects the Rambam. Anyway, so that was the first basic criticism of the Rambam. On the other extreme was a school of thought which wanted to disagree, which I call the quote-unquote more liberal approach. The Rambam had been too conservative. He had added too much. And therefore, they said, no, your ideas are fine, but who said that everything that you said is so crucially important that without which you could perhaps, lose Olam Haba, you're not fully Jewish in the Rambam's terminology. So one opinion, Chasdai Kreskis, said there should really be six Ikarim. We went through what those six were. And finally, the most well-known critique, that of Rav Yosef Albo, who was actually a student, perhaps, of Chasdai Kreskis, and a student of the Ran. He said there were three principles. Three principles. And we concluded last week's lecture by pointing out there was a little bit of discussion, if not debate, at the end about some of the analysis, but we showed two different analyses, one from Dr. Kellner, one from Rabbi Dr. Bleich. But they both agreed on one thing. They disagreed on a detail, and some of the people in the audience disagreed on a detail. And that was, the premise was that this wasn't as much a debate about the principles as it was what's the role of the principles. And that they demonstrated, each with their own little nuance, that the Rambam had one thing in mind when he made the principles, but the critics of him really had something else in mind. And if you look carefully at their language, they really were trying to do something else. What the Rambam was clearly trying to do was to have an authoritative and, in his view, comprehensive view of basic, bare minimum theology. The bare minimum, what does a Jew need to believe in order to have the most basic relationship in this world with God, and therefore to be eligible for an eternal relationship in the next world with God? And it's not clear that the other Rishonim, even when they disagreed on the details, but it's not clear that they disagreed that was the role of the principles. So that opened up a little bit of the possibility, which will be relevant as we get to tonight, for the fact that as much as there was disagreement, there may be certain overarching agreement. It's on that basic point, though, that I do want to discuss this evening, and I guess if one were interested in this angle, if you will, of our three lectures, I would say, on the blurb, on the flyers, I mentioned the history and the controversy, so to speak. So we've only just begun. If you will, the most sensitive or controversial part of our series is tonight. And that is because I want to discuss not only in more contemporary times, how accepted were the Rambam's 13 principles, but more specifically to discuss the implications of accepting them. Now, what the implications would be, assuming the Rambam's right in the next world, well, you know, we're all here now, so I can't speak in any definitive way about that. But there are implications. The Rambam laid them out for us. We saw this already in our first week of study together. Right? You're not Michlal Yisrael. The Rambam was drawing red lines, lines in the sand, if you take your metaphor, of what is considered acceptable Jewish belief. Who's in and who's out. And that certainly does have ramifications to this very day. And it's that which I'd like to discuss this evening. If you turn to the first page of your sources, I've put together a handful of just snippets. Some contemporary, some from a generation or two ago, just to show you, even into our very day, literally, a certain assumption, which perhaps many of you, and I hope when you walk out of here tonight, you won't fully disregard this at all, chas v'shalom, that would be a bad result. But probably most of you came into the lecture series assuming that is, as a given, that the Rambam was the last word, and perhaps that it wasn't even controversial. So that is, in fact, assumed by many writers. So, to give you a little bit of an earlier one, so to speak, going back over 100 years ago in European time, the Munkacsher Rebbe, I have some Hungarians here, the Munkacsher Rebbe, who was more well known for his tshuvas, known as the Minchas, you have to pronounce it correctly, a loser. So he also wrote a wide collection of other types of literature and essays, Hashkafa, etc., Sefer Divrei Torah. So if you look in the third volume, in the 96th essay, Siman Tzadi Vav, at the end, he has a whole tangent, but you know, this is almost like after the fact, he has a whole letter. And then in brackets, the last line, top right hand of your column, he just, as an aside, he almost points out, "Anachnu ma'aminim b'nei ma'aminim," we believers, the sons and children of believers, what do we believe in? What is he defining his belief? "V'yud gimel ikrim," which of course he's referring to the Rambam's 13 principles, "kipshutam," we take them literally and simply, "emes la'misan," they are absolute truth. So it just takes for granted, of course, the Rambam is right, and we define ourselves by the Rambam. Top left-hand side, you have a quote from the book. We saw this more extensively, some of his contributions last week. The 13 Principles by Rabbi Zachariah Fendel, a well-known late 20th century author of English Torah publications. He had done a lot of analysis of the machlokes between the Rambam and Rabbi Yosef Albo, which is where we looked at him last week. But he points out towards the end of his book, that of course, whatever the machloksim were back in the day, the Rambam Shlosha Eser Yikarim, the 13 principles have been accepted by all segments of the Torah community as the authentic formulation of the fundamental principles of the Torah faith. It is universally recognized as definitive halacha, the firm belief and adherence to each of the 13 principles is the sine qua non of Torah faith, through which, according to the words of the Rambam, an individual will be nichnas l'kal Yisrael. Very strong, there's no gray, there's no wiggle room. This is it. If you want to sign on, we're happy to have you, but this is acceptance. On the right-hand side, next to that, you have a book called Fundamentals of Faith, which is published by written by somebody, Rabbi Mordechai Blumenfeld. It is actually a write-up of based on audio tapes, I believe, and notes of Rav Yaakov Weinberg Zatzal, the previous Rosh Hashiva in Ner Yisrael, his shiurim that he had given in Ner Yisrael on the 13 principles. So in his introduction, this Rabbi Blumenfeld, about whom I know nothing else other than he wrote this book, Rabbi Blumenfeld, is he local? Does anyone know? No, not local. Okay. Rabbi Blumenfeld wrote the following in his introduction, page 18. This is Rabbi Blumenfeld writing. I believe this is not from Rabbi Weinberg, but I don't know that Rabbi disagreed or not, but this is an introduction which I don't believe is based explicitly on Rabbi Weinberg's shiurim. I think just the chapters after that are. It should be stressed that all, if I had bolded it, I would have bolded the all, because I think that's what he's trying to stress. All Torah scholars agree on the validity and significance of the principles. Now, perhaps he means contemporary, I don't know. It's certainly not true historically. But all, he says. Furthermore, in an article which was only 3 pages long and sparked a huge controversy, which we will get back to before the end of tonight's shiur, one of the outreach divisions, if you will, of Yeshiva University started publishing in 1989 a journal, an intellectual journal, Torah journal called the Torah Umada Journal. And in the first volume of that journal, one of the then Rosh Yeshiva, he's since moved on to another institution, Rabbi Yehuda Parnas, who was a long-standing, very, very esteemed and significant Rosh Yeshiva at YU, he published a three-page article, a very short piece, called The Freedom of Inquiry. The premise of the piece, which is fascinating, but not our topic tonight, is when we speak about Torah Umada, studying beyond limited Torah sources, are there any limits? Is the freedom of inquiry, as he referred to it, open-ended? Or perhaps even, according to the Torah Umada approach, there are certain things one shouldn't read, which ended up being his basic thesis, which he tried to prove. It was very controversial. Back and forth, articles, debates. But as a throwaway line, almost, I don't know if he realized what he was getting himself into or what he was inspiring. At the end of the article, on the last page, he's just summing up. You can see by the opening sentence, based on all of the above, which again was only four pages, it's a very short article. Based on all of the above, Torah Umada can only be viable if it imposes strict limits on freedom of inquiry and areas that may undermine the Yud Gimel Ikare Emunah. Again, now at all to be distracted by the main point which he's making, which is not at all our topic, although certainly a topic in its own right, which would require at least can someone say college? No, don't say it. Okay. However, the point he's making, which is parenthetical for him, but it's essential for us, is that he assumes as a given that what defines legitimate and illegitimate, the red line in Judaism, the Rambam's 13 principles. Fascinatingly, if one wanted to look, and I admit that there's a certain shtick factor here in me quoting this, but if one was looking for a little bit of a break in the orthodoxy, I use this with a lowercase o, that we have seen until now in contemporary writings, of all places one might find it in the under-the-page commentary in the Art Scroll Siddur. And it's in the Art Scroll Siddur. We saw this in those who were here the first week we had the class, first lecture. So I included for you at the end of Shacharis, where in many Siddurs they publish the Rambam's 13 principles, and I included for you it from the Art Scroll Siddur. So underneath that page, in any standard Art Scroll Siddur, you'll find this. They have a very nice little piece here. Historically, Judaism never separated, belief of performance, etc., etc. That's more of what we were talking about in the first week. He then points out 13 principles of faith, meaning the Ani Mamins, are based on the formulation of the Rambam, so they knew, they got it right. It's not written by the Rambam, the Ani Mamins. This is the point we made the first week. They're based on the Rambam's principles. And, underlined, have achieved virtually universal acceptance. It's not what you heard from Rabbi Findel. It's not what Rabbi Blumenfeld said, that's for sure. Right, but which is why I said I'm not sure if he means specifically contemporary, or he meant we just reject them. So it is somewhat surprising, though, to have this again. I'm not sure if anyone who reads the Art Scroll, maybe they'll read this part, or if they are appreciative of it. But I use this to say I don't want to make a mountain out of a molehill in the Art Scroll, but I want to use this as a transition for the fact that wittingly or not, they have perhaps taken us down a path which is a slightly perilous one, but I would like to go there with you for a little bit now. There have been two books that I know of, at least, in recent years that have, if you will, taken the virtually of the Rambam, of the Art Scroll, and stamped a capital V on it. That have not only from a scholarly perspective, but from an advocacy perspective, both written by people who are, I believe, considered mitzvah observant and orthodox, to point out not only the historical point of the fact that this is far from conclusive, but, and this is what's really important for us this evening, to focus on the implications of that. In other words, they advocate a certain political, if you will, position, which is certainly contrarian in contemporary Jewish culture, which is why they felt the need to advocate it, based on their scholarly research. The one which perhaps is interesting, the one book, which is the one we have quoted a lot last week and we'll mention again this week, which was written by Professor Kellner from the University of Haifa, was a high school classmate of Marcel Reicher's and a student of Hershey Hawk in St. Louis. Very brilliant fellow, a very big scholar. So he had the book, which we spoke about last week, Must a Jew Believe Anything? And by the time he gets to the end of the book, he has a whole chapter, two chapters, I should say, on contemporary issues. And it's recent, he was recently writing a review of a book, which we'll see shortly, where he points out that he doesn't think his book really made any inroads in the Orthodox community. And it's not, and people didn't get bothered by it. People didn't read it, I guess, so much. It wasn't as popular as he would have liked, I guess, but he was aware of that. But one book, which he was commenting on, which has gotten much attention, which is a relatively recent book, is a book written by a professor from the University of Scranton. That's not to be confused with the Yeshiva of Scranton, but the University of Scranton. A fellow grew up from West Orange, New Jersey. His PhD from Harvard. His name is Dr. Mark Shapiro. So we won't quote him again. So we will get back to Dr. Shapiro's. We will get back to Dr. Shapiro's position and his point and the controversy specifically and the substantive the critique perhaps which we can lay against Dr. Shapiro. But just to give you a sense, again, scholarly books written about medieval philosophy don't usually create social uproars because no one usually reads them. There's too many footnotes. They don't usually create the kind of controversy that popular Jewish newspapers would be writing about. Yet, at least in the New York area, the second biggest Jewish weekly, The Forward, it's not an advocacy for them, I think they're the second biggest. Maybe they're the biggest, I don't know. No, but someone else claims that they're the biggest, so I assume that they're the second biggest. But certainly a very well-known weekly newspaper, The Forward. If you look on the left-hand side, in March of last year, so just over a year ago, a whole article all about the controversy spawned by Dr. Shapiro's books. And he writes here, I'm just reading from the middle, of what is usually known as unimpeachable dogma, insisting, referring to the Rambam, that they have been the source of much dispute since Maimonides first articulated them in the 12th century. He says, don't take it so simple. Why does everyone assume that the Rambam is the last word? There have been controversies forever. Shapiro, however, contends that in his book, the Maimonides principles were never universally accepted among traditional Jews until recently. Now, in a similar vein, we mentioned that Dr. Kellner's premise, which was slightly different, was that more radical in a certain sense, namely that more than the details of the principles, that the Rambam was a radical break with Chazal. That Chazal never advocated principles of faith such as this, didn't attach or define Jewish loyalty based on belief. That was the Rambam's original idea. We discussed in detail, I won't repeat it this week, about whether we agreed or not with that thesis or not. That was his thesis. The bottom line of both of their theses, both books, is that they don't leave it in the theoretical, but they then take it to a lemaisa. They then advocate certain positions from that. So what I want to do is I want to study now, respectively, the two positions, or to see a little bit how strong that wall is of the Rambam, the Rambam, the Rambam, and again, each one in their own way to take Dr. Kellner and then Dr. Shapiro's positions, and we'll see where we end up. One thing which is worth noting, I only learned about this in my preparation for this series, which is fascinating, is, again, certainly a unconventional thinker, but a Gadol B'Yisrael, undoubtedly, one of the former chief rabbis of Eretz Yisrael, Rav Shlomo Gorin, so in a, not one of his more well-known Sfarim, I don't think, Sefer Toras HaShabbos, at the end, he has essays on the Rambam's principles and issues of philosophy. And he is very much bothered by the following question, which I set to you conceptually before we get to whether other people agreed or not with the Rambam. He has a much more radical suggestion. How come, he asks, we mentioned in the first week, for those who were here, that the Rambam has three famous books. The one he wrote when he was youngest was his commentary on the Mishnah, originally written in Arabic. And it was in that parish, his original opening book, that he wrote down the 13 principles. Rabbi Gorin is very bothered by why those were never repeated in the Mishneh Torah. The Rambam attaches such significance to these beliefs. How come we keep on having to dig out the Perush HaMishnayos? I had to give you a 5-minute historical introduction. What is the Perush HaMishnayos? Some people have heard of it. Some people have never heard of it. Why does he leave it tucked away in his least well-known publication? It's not like he wrote that one last. He wrote it first. So he had two other chances. And certainly Mishneh Torah, You'll tell me Mishnah Torah is about halacha. We pointed out that the opening chapters of Mishnah Torah do discuss philosophy. And in fact, there, as we studied together even in the first week, Hilchos Yisrael Torah and Hilchos Tshuva, the Rambam does review and take for granted some of the beliefs that he's already established in the Parashat Mishnayos. But never in Mishnah Torah does he say these are the 13 principles you have to believe. If you don't believe them, never does it. You know, so some people ask questions and leave it with a raised eyebrow. That was not Rav Goren's way. Rav Goren comes with a very radical conclusion. If you look at the bottom of the first page, the first underlined section, B'chozos, what does it appear to be? Kanira chazer bo midaito ekronis harishona. The Rambam changed his mind. Shehichshiv es yidiyosam kiyosodos ha'emuna v'hados, v'hizir ha'idiyosam ba'ofen miyuchad v'chayv kol Yehudi behem. The significance that the Rambam attached to these, overwhelming, overarching significance, you can't overstate how important the Rambam felt it was in the commentary on the Mishnah. That level of significance the Rambam retreated from. Look at the bottom. He says, Lo kavos am betzur kozos. In his book, his halachic book, Hayada Chazaka, the Mishnah Torah. I'm at the second underlying part there. Zemochiach, end of the line. What does this prove? What does it show us? Shabachozos, shina harambam lebesof es daito. The Rambam changed his mind. For rota lekavoa ikarim leemuna. And he did not want. Why? Ki kol haTorah kula. Umitzvaseha kalos kechamuros ikarim heim. Whose position is that? The Abar Banel. You mean, why didn't Rav Goren assume that? Because Rav Goren would say, if whatever the number is, that he should have told us in Mishnah Torah. I think the whole thing is crazy. But he says it. It's worth knowing, before we reflect on the significance of the fact that other people perhaps question the Rambam, here you have a great 20th century Gedolim. Again, it's always important, but Rosenzweig taught me this years ago, as important as it is to evaluate substance, it's also important to evaluate who the substance is coming from. You don't immediately accept or reject something based on who said it, but if a radical person says something radical, you look at it one way. If somebody who has a tradition as being more of a conservative thinker, right, you think about it sometimes, we'll have like the Supreme Court, a more conservative jurist, and he says something is more radical, again, that doesn't mean you're going to accept it or not, but you have to give it a real serious look, because this is so out of character. So this is not out of character for Rav Goren. In that sense, he was a controversial thinker. I'm not sure if even people know about this. Maybe he would have been. He got into a lot of trouble in his rabbinical career for controversial positions he took. I'm not sure if they knew about this one. Maybe they would have clapped him again if they known about this. But Rav Goren wouldn't have minded. You know, he was a very strong personality. But it's worth knowing that at least there is this shita out there. I don't think anyone accepts it. I've never seen it by anybody else. But this is Rav Goren's theory. It's very speculative and. You know, on issues of this importance and that are this controversial, I don't think you can be that speculative. If you can't prove it, I'm not apt to follow it. And I don't think he can prove it. But it's an interesting point, that's for sure. The diversion of because the different translations even of the Parish of Mishnayos. Yeah. That's what he's suggesting exactly. Now, I want to quote from you here. As we see, this is the quote here from Mark Shapiro's book. It's called "The Limits of Orthodox Theology," published by the Littman Library, which is out of London. So he mentions again. He reviews something which we saw last week, which is Dr. Kellner's position. Right, Dr. Kellner preceded him in his publication. He quotes here that Kellner focuses overwhelmingly on disagreements with Maimonides over whether certain principles are actually, quote, roots, ikarim, of Judaism. An entirely semantic issue. And I don't think it's that negligible, but it's certainly, relatively speaking, it's not about who's right, if the beliefs are true or not, it's about how to classify them, rather than the correctness of Maimonides' fundamental theological views. Just to give you a sense of the thin part of the ice that Dr. Shapiro wants to walk out on, look at the last underlined part. My concern, in contrast, is with those scholars who thought Maimonides' principles were wrong, pure and simple. So, we see here, and this will divide up the rest of our lecture into these two components, to what significance does Kellner attribute to the fact that there were these arguments of classification, and whether we should accept his point of view critique or not. And then, certainly the potentially more controversial part, Shapiro's argument of people who didn't accept the Rambam, period. Meaning when the Rambam says that there was no greater prophet than Moshe, there are people who say it's not true. And when the Rambam says, etc., people say it's not true. Not just that they held it's true, but it's not a principle. It's not true. It's wrong. He draws significant implications from that, and we will, question those at L. The issue of what the ramifications, I'm going to stand now, and hopefully that'll work for me. I'm giving myself a headache with the rocking back and forth. I'm probably giving you a headache as well. The question of the implications of the Rambam's position, and certainly to take the other extreme, if we were to reject the Rambam, are very, very sensitive. And I will certainly do my best to speak as carefully and as sensitively as possible. But it's worth knowing that there are topics that are, and there are topics. And we're in a topic with a capital T. Certainly, and we'll see this, I guess, by the end of the class, it's hard to know exactly how and when to delineate or date when and how. But certainly, there seems to be a long-standing, again, how long is a part of the question, assumption that at least in his worldview of defining in and out, who's with us, so to speak, and who's not, that the Torah community has, in fact, accepted the Rambam's principles. Many of the very strong debates that have existed, certainly going back to Europe and even in the beginning of immigration to America, mass amounts of Jews in this century, many of the debates that have taken place, many of the very strident positions that have been taken, admittedly strident positions, by Orthodox leadership vis-a-vis conservative and Reform Judaism, and more particularly conservative and Reform rabbis, without a doubt is directly connected to and attributed to this issue. It's not that, well, we don't accept them because they don't keep the same level of kashrus as us. Maybe they don't keep kosher at all. That may be true, but I think it's clear that that's not what fuels the Orthodox acceptance of them. It's the issue of theology. I'm not going to go through them, it would take too long, but Rav Moshe Feinstein, for example, has three very significant tshuvas, which I summarized, snippets of all three of them on the page for you here, in which he takes very strong positions. Very strong positions. And some of them are generally about the non-Orthodox denominations. Some of them are specifically about the non-Orthodox rabbis, a phrase that he probably wouldn't even have uttered. And it's all because of the theological issue. The term that is often repeated, which it relates to one of the Rambam's principles, is the lack of acceptance of Torah min haShamayim, the belief in the divine source of the Torah. There was an issue just 2 or 3 Pesachs ago. Perhaps you remember this. A very, very well-known, prominent, fancy conservative rabbi in Los Angeles. I think it was in his drasha on the first day of Pesach. Not a Reform rabbi, a conservative rabbi. Who made the point that Yetzias Mitzrayim, the Exodus, actually had never happened. It's all a metaphor. Because archaeologists have not found evidence, etc., etc. It was so explosive that by Chol HaMoed, I think he finally figured out a way to unify the Orthodox rabbinate of Los Angeles. And I believe, again, this is the kind of thing you see in like Yerushalayim. You know, hanging up, there were like posters on the walls. I mean, there was blood. So that's what Rav Moshe is talking about. It's interesting, Rav Moshe, although he realizes, I'm not sure of the dates of all the tshuvas, but there are times where he distinguishes. As he points out, Reform doesn't believe in anything. This is terms. But conservative, maybe yes. And there's no question, conservative has always been more complicated. But as others have pointed out, and we'll see this before we conclude as well, unfortunately, to take this most recent example of a concern, you know, it doesn't get more radical than that. Right? It does not get more radical than that. So the question is, again, that's just the question. If we want to, so to speak, deconstruct or analyze our own thinking, again, we've all more or less been brought up this way. But if you think about it, again, I don't just mean the reason why we may react to specific speeches or positions, but the thought, again, let me also say another point, which is, of course, that where to specifically draw the line in terms of interactions has been disputed for generations by great rabbanim. It was disputed in Europe at the founding time of Reform. It's certainly been disputed in America. And I'm not here to discuss now, you will speak in this forum, you won't speak in that forum. Easily imagine people coming from even the same intellectual background, but choosing to draw the line in different places. But the point is that even people who come from that perspective understand there has to be a line somewhere. And this is my most important, the point I'm trying to stress the most, I hope this is clear, the motivation for drawing the line is not because they, whoever the they is, whether it's the rabbi or the movement or the shul, the temple, whatever it is, it's not because they, you know, aren't makbid on chadash. It's not because they don't keep taras hamashpacha. That may or may not be true, but that's not it. What is it is the belief issue. Now, Kellner is very bothered by this, because he sees this as a victory, not just for the Rambam's 13 principles, but for the Rambam's entire way of thinking, which is the paragraph I included at the end of the 13 principles, which is the paragraph I included in the first source sheets, where after listening to 13, the Rambam says, this is it. We were stressing this the first week, how important the Rambam felt it is. This is the line defining what who is and who isn't. Kellner prefers a different approach. If you turn over the page, this is towards the end of his book, Must a Jew Believe in Anything? Again, this was published 5 years before Dr. Shapiro. This was in 1999. Kellner writes the following. He's going with, it should all be based on mitzvah observance. It should not be based on belief. All Jews, therefore, are on the same continuum. This is a very famous line of his. For those who obey more and those who obey fewer. There is no absolute in or out here, saved or damned, orthodox or heretical. Rather, the question becomes, where on the continuum does one stand and in which direction is one going? It's a little short paragraph. I would say it's even nicely written, but it's really, really radical. And he knows that. He wants to be. Don't say you're in or you're out based on what you believe. We're going to throw that out. It's all based on what you keep. And let's be honest, nobody keeps everything. And probably there's really no one who keeps nothing. Right? If you include mitzvot b'adam l'chavero, interpersonal halachos, everyone helps somebody sometime. A nice person, speak nicely to somebody. So it's just one big continuum. This one does more mitzvos, this one does less mitzvos. But we're all on one continuum. Again, and his goals are very admirable, because he wants to promote achdus. Now it's worth noting that even he, you know, right before, you know, you see this often in life, in other, all sorts of spheres, people, you know, walk right up to the cliff, then they look down. Not everyone's prepared to make that jump. So even he, at the end of the book, 9 pages, 10 pages later, page 125, 126, he backtracks a bit. And he creates the following distinction. So there's a difference, this is in the next section here, there's a difference between official dogma and heresy and not heresy, heretical, not heretical, which is what he wants to reject. But at the same time, he does acknowledge that there are claims which place one outside the historical community of Israel. That's not to say that people are technically heretics. We don't care, that's not our issue. But it is to say that they have placed themselves beyond the broadest limits of historical Jewish communal consensus. Now, I'm not sure which beliefs he thinks, you know, if a conservative rabbi can say that the Exodus didn't happen, I would certainly make the argument that that would fit into this category. I'm not sure if he would or not. I don't know. But even he wants to say, you know what, I'm not, you know, he has one of the chapters that's called Heresy Hunter. Like it's a new superhero. But he thinks it's a villain. That's the point of the whole chapter, is that he thinks it's a villain. We shouldn't be hunting for other people's heresies. He's not interested in that. We should be focusing on, what's the term for this? Anyone know? Not orthodox, but? Very good. It has to do with behavior. And listen, so somebody's more orthopraxic, someone's less. It's a continuum, he says. True, if you have certain beliefs, you might not be part of the Jewish historical consensus. But that's not the same thing as being called a heretic. That's basically his position. Now, as we saw last week, even when we discussed his more theoretical and scholarly analysis, Dr. David Berger, in his review in Tradition Magazine, so he, like a surgeon, mamish, piece by piece, criticizes, yes?
It's ironic that Felder, when he backtracked when we looked down the cliff,
yeah.
He actually seems to use exactly the Rambam's phraseology. Nichnas li gzura.
No? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Maybe he was...
He stamped that word.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Listen, he knows that book by heart. He knows it better than any of us in the room. So maybe he was doing it intentionally. I don't know. I mentioned he has three books on this topic. He's the most active scholar probably in the world on this topic. Doesn't make him right, but it's, you know, he's put in the work. So Dr. Berger, in his review, after discussing, right, you have to get last week's source sheets to know all the theoretical objections that he had to Dr. Kellner. But what is, so we've just seen what Dr. Kellner's practical result is. So it comes along Dr. Berger and says, in light of all these reservations, I cannot endorse a proposal to rethink our assessment of conservative and reform Judaism through a prism which denies the existence of dogmatic benchmarks for authentic Judaism. Then he makes an incredibly sharp point. He says, even from Kellner's own perspective, as we would say, l'shitascha, he's wrong. Even from his own perspective, he's wrong. He says, if I followed the book's argument correctly, we are meant to leapfrog medieval Maimonidean approaches and go back to the rabbinic wellsprings. And once again, that was Kellner's thesis. But the Rambam made a radical break. It was the Rambam who focused on theology. Chazal don't talk about that. Let's go back to Chazal. That was, again, in one sentence, a summary. But then he points out, the bottom line, though, as we saw repeatedly, there was that Mishnah in Sanhedrin. The Chazal do speak about heretics. They do speak about Minim. They spoke about it less comprehensively than the Rambam, not as systematically as the Rambam. They do talk about it. And what are some of the things that they mention? So he gives a little bit of review of that. And then he says in the second paragraph, compare this arbitrary, but I think perfectly fair little list with a similar one appropriate for Reformed Judaism. Violation of Shabbos, eating forbidden foods, rejection of the absolute authority, both the written and the oral law, etc., etc. Bottom line, he says, is even if you were to go with Chazal, and you assume that that's a more embracing, open, tolerant position, which may not be anyway, but even if you assume that, which Kellner does, they fall short. He then points out very strongly, he says, in these last chapters, funny, he says, why Kellner never goes back to quoting Chazal. He says the reason is because even according to Chazal, he's wrong. That's Berger's very sharp argument in rejection. And he says here the last three lines of the left-hand column, by any criterion, theological or behavioral, Kellner's approach to Reform Judaism is inconsistent not only with the views of Maimonides, but also with the pronouncement of the Talmudic sages. And then Dr. Berger moves on to the more dicey gray area, and that is conservative Judaism. This is the right-hand column. Regrettably, even mainstream conservative Judaism today runs afoul of both explicit rabbinic criteria defining sectarianism and matters of both belief and practice. Again, he goes on, he points this out, he gives some details here. Points out, true, there is such a thing maybe as a difference between historical consensus and theology. We should be respectful, civility, dealing with their leaders, dealing with the people. But, he says in the last paragraph, I must insist on terms like legitimate and authentic. We have an obligation to maintain the boundaries of faith bequeathed us by our ancestors, and we cannot do this by describing even fundamental deviations as points on a continuum. He then concludes, and with this I'll leave this section and move into our final discussion, with an autobiographical vignette. You'll remember that we saw in the past people pointing out that the purpose of these lists sometimes were both klapei chutz, to draw red lines to differentiate the rabbinic community from the Karaim, from Christianity, from Islam, but also to be self-educating. So Dr. Berger writes very, very movingly about how when he was young, he had all sorts of questions about biblical criticism. And he wasn't really sure. He had open intellectual questions. And he writes, honestly, that what eventually resolved these questions for him wasn't just reading certain things and being made aware of more sophisticated arguments in defense of tradition, etc., etc. That's true, he says, but one of the main things that kept him on the straight and narrow was the belief that if he would have given in to whatever his questions were, he was out. He was, you know, the apikoros. And the fear of that was a good thing for him. He writes very movingly at the end that if he had been told that it's okay, you have your questions, and perhaps you'll reject this belief, but that's okay, because you're still a point on the continuum. He writes at the end, I'm afraid to face the question of what might have happened. He's talking about himself. Right? Very honest. I mean, this is somebody who's already older and very, very accomplished and respected rabbi and scholar, and he's writing about it as a teenager. How important it was that we rejected, in practice, if you will, Mahavdil, Kellner for Moshe Feinstein. I want to now turn to the most recent event. They say my last years in YU, this was like a real brouhaha. A real brouhaha. You should know that in one of the articles, that article in the foreword, he was pointing out how much of a rage this issue has become, that not only are they reading this all over in New York and in modern Orthodox places and in colleges and everything, but even he's heard that the article that he wrote and different things have been passed around in such right-wing institutions as Ne'er Israel in Baltimore, Maryland. This made the rounds, this controversy. Again, just a few years old. He also, again, it's an academic book, and just to be fair to him, if you just want to look at the footnotes, I don't know if I've ever seen a book like this. Tafladik. From ancient Arabic, medieval philosophy, to the most, I mean, he's the one who quoted the Munkacher. Everything. I mean, the guy is unbelievable. It's an unbelievable book from an academic, scholarly perspective. But he also is not content on just leaving it as an academic theoretical discussion. He also wants to talk Lamaisa. And he makes the point, basically, given this fact, again, the old, if you will, and again, I don't want to be fair, it wasn't just from Moshe Feinstein. Right? Rav Soloveitchik had a very famous psak. Right? If the only way you could hear shofar, you were in a city, the only way you'd be able to hear the shofar in Rosh Hashanah is to go in a non-Orthodox synagogue. Said Rav Soloveitchik, better not to hear the shofar. So it wasn't just Rav Moshe. Moshe put it down in paper. He wrote tshuvas, but this is the party line. So this is something that Shapiro also doesn't like. He makes the point, because he says, look, after all, the Rambam was never accepted. What happened? What's happened? All of a sudden, now the Rambam became the last word. It historically was never accepted. He's talking about how we should be more open-minded, therefore, because of this. And again, if you look at the last line of this paragraph that I have here for us, this is how he ends. The lesson for moderns is clear. So, again, I could have spent 10 weeks, 20 weeks, just studying his book with you. After he has an opening and a conclusion, the chapters in the middle are going through principle by principle, ikar by ikar, showing you the different other Rishonim and Achronim who argued on points of it. I mean, again, as I say, from a scholarly perspective, it's a lot to read. But we can't do that. We won't get anywhere. But I want to just mention the larger issue. He says that there are debates, there are machloksin, right? There were people who disagreed with different points. We generally believe, right, in absolute free choice. None other than Rav Chasdai Kreskes, we mentioned last week, he doesn't see it as so absolute free choice. He has a different view. The Ralbag has some very controversial views. The Ibn Ezra seems to say that the last 8 psukim of the Torah were not written by Moshe. There are views out there. So what do we do with it? So his perspective is, therefore, you'll pick yours, I'll pick mine. You know, what are you going to say? You can't believe that, but Ibn Ezra believed it. So I'll ask you a better question and hopefully therefore give you a better answer. Not mine, but the Chasam Sofer's. Even in Chazal, there were, at least that we know of, some debates. And in fact, there's a very infamous or famous Gemara of Masechet Sanhedrin that tells us that the Tanaitic sage Hillel, again, there's multiple Hillels, so I don't want to get into the history of which Hillel we're talking about. One of the Hillels denies the belief in Mashiach. Gemara says this. Not that he thought that the Jews wouldn't be redeemed, but that the redemption would come directly at the hand of God, there would not be an earthly messenger. There would be no Mashiach. Gemara quotes this. So what do you do with Hillel? And what would you do, am I or you allowed to say, Kimli Kehillel, I want to believe like Hillel. Yeah, it's quoted in the Gemara. It's rejected. He's not accepted in the Gemara, but he is quoted, absolutely. Right, absolutely, right? We're not hiding it. Right? So the Chasam Sofer has a tshuva. Someone wrote him, right? Usually they ask them, you know, what to do about the blech and this kind of stuff. So this is a tshuva on the Ikrei Emuna. You don't find these that often. He even quotes, how many are there? The person asked them, what do we do? The Rambam says there's 13, or the Abel says there's 3. Lo yadati shum navkusa. Who cares? That's the Chasam Sofer. Ki im kriya shem bovad. He says these are all theoretical debates. Because everyone agrees, is what he's trying to say. They're all true, and we have to believe in all of them. The Rambam says this is a principle. The Rambam says this is a principle. It's interesting, but theoretically, it's not practical. Ah, you'll say, second line, he near of Hillel. What about this Hillel? After all, you can't say that he agreed. He disagreed. He says it doesn't matter because we reject him. Not all opinions are equally valid. Gam bazeh leis hilchus hakavasei. We rejected him. Ha'omer ein mashiach, the kimli krebi Hillel. Right, a guy gets up there and says, I want shlishi. I'm after Yonah and Yom Kippur. I'm a Jew in good standing. But by the way, you should just know I don't believe in Mashiach. What? You don't believe in Mashiach? Yeah, I hold like Hillel. What, you think Hillel was an Apikoros? So says the Chasam Sofer. Somebody says that? Hari hu kofer b'chlal ha-Torah. We look at that person as a heretic. The kaile achrei rabam lahatos. Kaven sherabul of chachma Yisrael. Amru daloka vosei. Shuv ein adam uya himashech acharav. Hillel was allowed to have that belief because there was no consensus at his time, apparently. But once there was a consensus, like in any other area of halacha, majority, overwhelmingly in this case, he's the only one who says this, reject him. That, again, it's on the books, we know about it. But it's not a legitimate option anymore. It's a heretical option. Rabbi Bleich, getting back to the book with perfect faith that we've quoted a few times, he summarizes this. He points out at the end of the first paragraph, he sums us up. He goes, Rabbi Moshe Sofer, that's the Chasam Sofer, quite cogently points out that there were such views to be held by contemporary Jews. There were such views, they would be branded a heretic. Yet the advancement of this opinion by one of the sages of the Talmud carried with it no theological odium. Why is that? How come Hillel could believe it, but I can't? Very simple, he says. Before the authoritative formulation of halacha with regard to belief, Hillel's opinion could be entertained. But following this resolution, that's negated. Normative halacha demands acceptance of the belief that the redemption will be effected through the agency of a mortal Messiah. So this is an easy one, frankly, because this, we know it's already from the Gemara. Its weakness, so to speak, Barry, is its strength. Because in the Gemara, we know that it was also rejected. Well, what about all of the details which are not in the Gemara, but the Rishonim are arguing about? So this Rabbi Bleich admits is a little bit more sticky. Certainly, next paragraph, there are many points regarding various articles of faith which have not been formally resolved by the sages of the Talmud. In the absence of a definitive ruling, the question which presents itself is, would the exponent of a certain view with regard to any of these matters consider an opponent of his followers simply to be in error? Would he view them as heretics as well? That's our question. Hillel, you'll say, all right, the Gemara rejected him. What about the Ibn Ezra? Right, what, you know? There's no question, right, if the Ibn Ezra lived now, he would not be on the Mosek Dolya Torah. It's not nearly firm enough. There's no question. I guess the question which they might say is, well, if he lived now, would he say the same things that he did then? Maybe that's a fair question. But the question is, again, I mean this more seriously. What do we do with this stuff? Is it just interesting and theoretical, or could somebody really say, therefore, let's be a little bit more tolerant in these beliefs? So recently, a very good review was written. There's been a number of reviews, but I say there was one that was very good, of this book by Yitzi Blau. Blau was actually the son of Rabbi and Dr. Blau, who are coming, when? 2 weeks? For the layman Shabbaton. Rabbi Blau is the mashgiach at the yeshiva, and he has a son. His oldest son's name is Benny, who was in Shomrei, I think, 2 years ago, right? 3 years ago, Rosh Kol in Cleveland. His other son, Yaakov, who was a Rebbe in New Jersey. He has the middle son of his three, is made Aliyah, teaches in Hamiftar and Efrat. Very, very well-known, right? He's a real thinker, he's a real philosopher. Yitzi Blau, Rabbi Yitzchak Blau. So he has an article in this most recent, 2004, Torah Mada Journal, which is where this all started. I neglected to mention, just to point out the controversy, Mark Shapiro originally wrote, the book is an adaptation and enlargement of an article. His article was a response, a little bit vitriolic, unfortunately, a response to Riparnas' original article. I forgot to make that point clear. This is so you should know the roadmap of the Machlokas. Riparnas wrote his article, assuming for granted that, of course, everything is by the Rambam's 13 principles. And a few years later, in the same journal, Dr. Shapiro wrote a 50-page article. Yeah, it was long. But see, figure, that's what somebody said to him. 50-page article? You should write a book. Taka should write a book. That's what happened. He wrote a 50-page article with hundreds of footnotes arguing on Rabbi Parnas. I can just imagine Rabbi Parnas was like, I just wrote 3 pages. I didn't think this was... I don't think he knew what he was getting himself into. I don't think he could have expected it even. So then, whatever Rabbi Parnas responded, didn't respond. Anyway, then Shapiro turned this into a book. So once he turned it into a book, now there's a review of the book by Rabbi Blau. So he points out, and this will be our last section for the evening, he points out that there's some very good and valuable things, certainly educational in the book, but that fundamentally the thesis is very problematic and very flawed. So first of all, it's always a good thing as a reviewer to start off by, especially if you're going to wield the knife afterwards, right? You start off benachas. Shapiro succeeds in proving his essential thesis. He shows that it's not true that there was universal acceptance. It was not true either during the period of the Rishonim or the Achronim. He gives some examples. For example, recognized authorities allowed prayer addressed to angels. Others admitted the possibility of another prophet equaling Moshe's prophetic ability. Others suggested that God could change the Torah if he saw fit to do so. Some claimed that God created the world out of a pre-existing matter. Every one of those beliefs are heretical, according to Rambam. One of the 13 principles is that there's no prophet who will be like Moshe. One of the principles is that God created the world yesh me'ayin, ex nihilo, out of nothing. And yet, there were isolated authorities on virtually every one of the principles who didn't just quibble with classification. They argued on substance. That's true. And again, with an unbelievable amount of bakias, as we would say, tremendous scholarship, Dr. Shapiro actually lists those. So Dr. Shapiro wants to do this because he wants to make the whole world more open-minded and more tolerant, combat those forces. The first thing that Rabbi Blau points out is that perhaps there are some problems in that direction, but there's other problems in the opposite direction, which unfortunately he's played himself into, which that is, and this is the bottom of this page, Shapiro makes no reference to the danger found on the opposite point of the Orthodox spectrum. Under the influence of modern relativism and epistemological skeptics, many contemporary writers attempt to deny the significance of dogmas in Judaism altogether. We opened with this 2 weeks ago. But it wasn't just Mendelssohn in the 18th century. This is going on today. So, for example, he quotes a professor who teaches in at least two well-known seminaries in Israel, Dr. Tamar Ross, who has published a number of articles in which she has said, among other things, again, she claims this is Rav Kook's view. I think that she's wrong, but she claims it's the name of Rav Kook, that Jewish beliefs have only instrumental value, but Judaism, not specifically, a cognitive truth. She argues for a position in which we view Buddhism, Christianity, and Islam as equal manifestations of the same truth as Judaism. This is someone who wears a tichel. Other things. There's stuff going on. Maybe not in Baltimore, but there's stuff going on. So don't take that out of context. There is things bubbling. It's not so simple. And look what he says here, the next line, our good buddy, Menachem Kellner, published a book arguing that the beliefs are not the basis for deciding who's part of the religious community, right? That was what we just saw. According to the Kellner, you're not in or out based on your belief. You're all part of a continuum. Good, you were listening. Thank you, Rabbi. And he points out that there's this whole phenomenon, right? There are a number of shuls that have cropped up in Yerushalayim as well as in the New York area. Self-referential usage of the term, they're not Orthodox shuls, they're halachic, are all part of this ideology. No doubt, adherence to the orthoprax approach will be quick to utilize Shapiro's work as support. Don't make such a big deal about Emunah. Look, Emunah's always been debated. Let's talk about the other things. So first of all, on a practical level, this is dangerous stuff we're dealing with. And then as he points out here, and I will paraphrase him, although this deserves its own lecture, as he says, this deserves its own essay, he goes, I will briefly explain why the orthopraxe position is unacceptable. Just to give you as a simple example, which I think is the one he's going to use, let's assume we're talking about kashrus. Right? So somebody could follow the laws of kashrus based on a belief they derive initially from the written Torah, as understood by the sages in the oral Torah, and that in that sense they're divinely mandated. Of course, the rabbinic legislation that has crept in, but essentially that's the theology with which one can view kashrus, or one could still keep kosher. You can be orthopraxic, but for some other reason, it's traditional, it's cultural, and the question is, isn't that really the same thing? Right? I'm going to keep more glatt kosher than you, because that's been traditional. My grandfather in Europe did it, so I'll do it. But not that I believe. What's the difference? So I think Rabbi Blau here makes a very, very strong point. He says, if Judaism demands halachic practice without an ideology of belief to justify that practice, then that mitzvah performance becomes reduced to mindless behaviorism. If we admit the need for a background structure of beliefs, but hold that those beliefs radically change over time, then it becomes meaningless to talk of an ongoing tradition of Judaism. So he gives a cute example, a Save the Whales organization that is maintaining the same policies even after the ideology shifts from a concern of animals to a belief in whales as deities. And obviously a little bit humorous, but he says, this group's unchanging practice, despite the fact that it's the same whatever their position they're advocating, but it would hardly be considered the same group. Likewise, Judaism that maintains halachic observance but drops traditional conceptions of God would actually be an entire new entity. When kashrus changes from the command of an omniscient, benevolent God to folk practice, the shift in ideology is justifying observance is too dramatic to talk about, and there's our word again, continuity or continuum, in Kellner's terms, of Yahadus. Another point which is worth noting, there's a very well-known, I think he also has been at Shamre years ago, Dr. Schneer Sid Lyman, also a giant of a professor. So I don't know if he's published anything, but apparently when this came out, the next week in March last year, he spoke. Apparently he gives a shiur wherever he lives in Brooklyn every week. So on one of these email lists called Eish Dos, which is an email list of like intellectual Jewish Orthodox discussions anyway, so somebody who heard Dr. Lyman speak wrote up Dr. Lyman Shal Shudah shiur. And Dr. Lyman's shiur was about Shapiro's book. So one of the points he makes, which is really the most important one I guess to take away from, is that while you may find individuals, great authorities even, who disagreed with a point here or a point there, there's no one who disagrees with all of them. There's not even anyone who disagrees with most of them. In other words, anyone who might have a detail about one but agree with the other 12, so to speak. If you look here on the left side of the page, whatever you'll say about people arguing with a detail here and there, that does not make the point that those who disagree with one generally agree with the others. Right? On the contrary, even if you have someone who disagrees with one specific example, there's an overwhelming majority of Rishonim who agree with the 13 principles, as we find no Rishon who claims that there are no principles or that the Rambam's 13 are completely untrue. It's not just in modern times that people have accepted the Rambam. It is a consensus even of Rishonim. Even substantively, there were people who argued about this one or that one.
Right.
But the bottom line is, for the overwhelming majority, they accepted the concept of red lines. Number two is, even somebody who disagreed with one, you can't add them up and say, you see, people argue on all of the Rambam. Because the guy who argued on one agreed with the other 11 or 12.
As red lines also?
I think so, yeah. And again, the main point of Shapiro's is more. It's not just a question of if it's red line or not. Is that it might not be true. That's Shapiro's, which is a stronger argument if he would be right. No, it's a different thesis. So I want to conclude now with the one last point, which is, where does this leave us? So I think it's interesting. Rabbi Blau has the following suggestion. First of all, on the right-hand side from one page 83, he points out that even the disagreements, some of them are in details. So the truth is, whether the Rambam would have agreed with this or not, I don't know, but certainly we, if we want to form a consensus, we could reformulate very slightly, with nuances, some of the Rambam's ideas in a way which would actually encompass some of the critics. So he gives, again, a number of examples. Some Rishonim, this is on the right-hand side, after the underlying part. Some Rishonim may believe in a Bria Yesh Meyesh. That means that the world was created from something that already existed, this primordial matter or something. But we can still state an overarching dogma that God preceded our world and created it at a given point in time. And that's essentially Rambam's point. And if we formulated it that way, there would actually be no one who would disagree. And again, he gives other examples of this. The bottom line is, so if that's the case, so where do we, what criterion can we use to determine what should be legitimate or not? So he concludes at the end here, this is page 186 from Rabbi Blau. It seems reasonable to me to suggest the following three criteria for the illegitimacy of a doctrine. You have to have three things going for you, or not, as the case may be, in order for us to redline you off the page. Only if all three criteria are met. Number one, almost no rabbis of stature in Jewish history taught this doctrine. Number two, the doctrine conflicts with other Torah ideals, or the simple thrust of Tanakh and Chazal. And number three, this conflict with the Torah or Chazal revolves around the matter of momentous import. So he says, for example, let's say somebody said, I don't believe that there ever was a Navi Ovadja. I don't believe it. Show me. Prove it to me. There was never a Navi of Ovadja. So according to this, he makes the point. He says, well, listen, number one, almost no rabbis of stature, almost no one said this, so he's already got one strike. Number two, this doctrine conflicts with other Torah ideals or the simple thrust of Tanakh. That's strike two. But what about number three? Is this a matter of momentous import? Probably not. Nothing. Judaism does not hang or fall whether Rav Avadja lived or not. Nothing against Rav Avadja. I'm sure he was a very important person. But it's not true. It's not the same thing as saying Moshe didn't exist. So that might be an unconventional, maverick view that necessarily would mean that it's out. That's not true. Right. Except for the fact that, again, there's a variety of opinions on this, which, again, not to get sidetracked, but there's no question that there are many classical authorities who look at different parts of Tanakh as being metaphoric. That is not impossible. So, again, it would be radical. Again, it's not saying this wouldn't be radical. Question is, what are the input? But it's a fair point. Maybe you'd have to readjust that the point. But he does make the point. Again, I'm not sure if he had this in mind or not, or just a coincidence. This fellow from a few years ago in Los Angeles, denying the Egyptian exodus on the other hand, well, that would be three strikes. And you're out. We could go one by one. I think his point is that to deny, absolutely deny, something that was actually one of the 13 Karim, I think he would think would violate all three. I think that's correct. I don't think he's arguing with the Chasam Sofer. The Chasam Sofer basically says that to deny that is to be a kofar. Although we should not be quick to employ this veto, we should reject some maverick and problematic positions taken by recognized authorities. In other words, again, this is certainly not to do at home for everybody, but the bottom line is, as difficult as it might be, there are certain opinions that might be out there which we could say, listen, it's not the mainstream, it wasn't the consensus, despite however great this person was 1,000 years ago, whatever. But this is, it was a maverick, so to speak, position. But there could be others that we say, it's not just, it's rejected. You can't say, this one speaks to me more. How to figure out which one fits into which, though these could be very important. It's also important to know that you don't necessarily treat everyone, and I say this very seriously, not every rabbi is the same. Meaning, again, an Ibn Ezra or somebody, this is a major person. Dr. Shapiro, again, it's part of his scholarly brilliance. He digs up people, trust me, you and I have never heard of. That doesn't mean that 600 years ago in Algeria they weren't great. But they don't bear the same historical significance to Jewish tradition as Ibn Ezra. And maybe you'll argue Ibn Ezra is not the same as somebody else. I don't know. Again, This is not necessarily to try at home for everybody to figure this stuff out, but it's worth keeping in mind. As a final point, I want to mention, with this we'll close. It's interesting. I saw this. It was in Dr. Berger's review. Again, Dr. Berger's review is about 5 years old, I believe. And it's funny because it was just something that I had just heard from Rabbi Willig. Rabbi Willig, I think I mentioned this in the past, that he and Rabbi Willig grew up together. So maybe they think alike. I don't know. They're very good friends. But it's worth noting that as recently as this year, in some very controversial episodes emanating out of Yerushalayim, the term kfira and heretic is stuff that's bandied about a lot. Earlier this year, it had to do with issues relating to evolution and the age of the universe. What? I'm just talking. No. Still didn't hear you. The point is, right, there's nothing, right? The Rambam doesn't speak about evolution. It's not one of the 13 principles. So what we have, and that's, again, an example, perhaps. Again, I'm not endorsing evolution as compatible with Jewish tradition or not. That's a separate question, which I'm not at all qualified to answer, actually. But the point is, you have, and this is actually a serious point. I'll give you 10 other examples, unfortunately, which are more tragic, because they're about less important things. The bar for kfira is lower and lower and lower. And the point which Dr. Berger makes in this piece is that that's one of the many unintended problems when you start playing around with the Rambam's list. Once you say it's not these 13, so many of the people who want to say that want to make the list shorter. But once that's not the list, then what's to keep people from expanding the list? And this is, again, very beautifully written by Dr. Berger. Finally, an unanticipated consequence of the refusal to draw red lines may well be the fostering of intolerance within orthodoxy itself. Since every orthodoxy, indeed every coherent movement, must have boundaries, setting them in a reasonable place encourages respect for the differences within those boundaries. Whereas within orthodoxy, we all know that orthodoxy is not monolithic, but at least usually is the case. We can all agree who is orthodox, what is orthodoxy, and we know that there are certain machloksim, but those, important as they are details. Again, people sometimes get too fahitzed about the details, but we know that they're just details. The problem is, once you lose these lines, refusing to set them at all may lead to the blurring of the central and the peripheral, the ikra and the tefil, and lead to the position that virtually all deviations delegitimate. It hardly needs to be said that this danger is very much with us. Yeah. That was Kalner. I'm not sure about Shapiro, but well, Kellner does at the end backtrack, and that's where he has this phrase. So some of you may know Dr. Berger is perhaps more well-known in contemporary circles now for not a review, but a book that he wrote. And the book that he wrote was... The book that he... I didn't hear that either. The book... I'm not sure what you said that I didn't hear, but I didn't hear it. The book... I'm trying to be deliberately vague here. The book that he wrote had to do with, again, if one were to look at it in light of this, one of the Rambam's 13 principles, right, about the belief in Mashiach. And Dr. Berger's point was that you have a group which is ostensibly considered orthodox, which in his view has so radically changed, not that there is such a belief, but the details of the belief, that such radical differences in belief are themselves a problem. In this review, I didn't include it, he makes a reference to that campaign that he's waged, and he points out that he himself, at least on that, has tried to use shy away, as strong as he's been, shy away from the word heretical, to leave open some possibilities. Not that they're not right, that they're right. He thinks they're terribly wrong. Which is why he points out, and this is his drumbeat, is there. It's a radical departure. Again, it's almost a little bit a la Kellner-esque from the historical understanding of Mashiach. And this happens to be, again, just the debate about whether there could be a Mashiach who has died, could a Mashiach come back to life or not, which the Rambam actually rejects explicitly about Bar Kokhba, whether that itself is considered as heretical as rejecting the belief in Kvira, in Mashiach itself. So even as recently as when this book came out, so I know that the question was asked, for example, and to take two great authorities of our day, Rav Yashiv and Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, argued on that very point. So how to figure out which details, you know, now would belief in something like Jesus, that might be a different issue, because according to most Rishonim, that's a violation of Avodah Zarah. So that is certainly... Okay, as I say, this is a different series which I probably will never give. But Dr. Berger himself is not afraid, I don't think, to speak about it. And certainly it's a book that's... I would recommend reading the book, though. I would recommend reading the book. So let's just sum up and conclude our series now. We have seen a lot, but we have left out much more. It's impossible. We didn't actually study any of the principles themselves. We alluded to some of them, but as we mentioned in our flyer in the blurb before the series, this was supposed to discuss more of an overarching historical view, understanding some of the history of the Rambam, the controversies that have surrounded it. And there's no question, again, that I think it's to this very day, and I certainly would not advocate changing this. The general consensus has been, certainly within the Orthodox community, to use, again, sometimes it's unconsciously, but to use not only the Rambam's details of the 13, but even his whole mindset, again, the mindset which Kellner didn't like, the mindset of defining legitimacy and illegitimate in and out based on issues of belief. And so to speak, once you're on the team, then you can bat 1,000, you can bat 100, but you're still on the team. The ticket to the team is these ideas. And again, that just raises the bar for us. Again, I can't say it any more than the Rambam did, how significant these issues of belief are. But it is worth knowing, I'm always a believer, that the educated consumer is always better. You know, I had a thought, maybe I shouldn't even teach this stuff. You know, am I opening a Pandora's box? It's possible, I risk that. But as a general, my belief is to give people more information, not less. But it's worth knowing this. Someone shouldn't be able to, you know, throw something out at you and you're like, what? Someone doesn't believe in the Rambam? It's no question, again, I said this before I started, I don't have an answer even at the end. If you want to pinpoint where and when this became so universally accepted, I don't know the answer to the question. Whether the Rambam wrote Yigdal or the Ani Mamas or not, the fact that they exist and they go back hundreds of years, that they've been in the Siddurim for hundreds of years, is symptomatic of the significance with which the Jewish people have accepted them. What will be, right? We'll get up to Shemayim after 120. I don't know. Is it possible that God left himself a little bit more wiggle room than the Rambam wanted to leave him for letting somebody in or out of Olam Haba? It's definitely possible. But that's not for us. In this world, again, I echo Dr. Berger's sentiments. We treat all Jews with respect and civility. But at the same time, we have to be strong in our convictions for what we believe. We hope other people would have believed with them too. But even if they don't, we have to understand that for us, despite the interesting scholarly debates, this Pilpul Ba'alma, this is what we accept to be the cardinal principles of our tradition and our faith. And again, how to relate specifically in different contexts, these are shilas I get every now and then myself, relatives and friends, how do you do things? These are important questions, how to relate. But it's worth knowing that no one wants to stand in judgment of other people. It's not a comfortable position, and there are some people I know that are very comfortable with it, and I don't like that. Shouldn't be comfortable, but sometimes it's necessary. So you do it with humility, with respect, but at the same time you have to do it. And that is, again, perhaps the overriding legacy of the Rambam. You know, we say, Mimosha ad Moshe lo kam kamosha, as I said in the first week, more significant than anything else on a practical level has been these principles. I hope we'll have more opportunities to study them. Perhaps we'll have a second series next year where we discuss some of the details if there's an interest. I can already tell at least two other suggestions for series. But Mr. Shem will be able to do this next year, and I thank all of the hosts again. I thank everyone for coming. I'm sorry I kept you a little bit late, but I don't have a next week to add anything. So I had to get it all in now. Thank you very much.